This is the Dream Team Tapes, a Diversion Podcast's original series, in association with iHeartRadio.
This is the story of the United States Olympic basketball team that won gold in Barcelona in 1992, known worldwide as the Dream Team. Welcome to Episode 5 of the Dream Team Tapes. I'm Jack McCallum. We have moved from San Diego, where the Dream Team completed a week of practice, and on to Portland, Oregon, for something called the Tournament of the Americas, where the U.S. team had to qualify for the Olympics. Portland was the capital of the basketball world in the summer of 92. Their beloved Blazers took the Jordan Bulls to six games, the NBA draft that produced Shaquille O'Neal and Christian Laettner, the two college stars who were the only players considered to join the Dream Team from college, was held there 10 days after the finals ended. And then the Dream Team arrived for their first official public demonstration of, well, worldwide dominance. I would venture to say that all of us who were around for the weeks of action in Portland had a great time in that great city. It was an excellent series. It included the famous Jordan shrug game in Chicago when he hit six first-half three-pointers, the majority of them on Clyde Drexler, and at one point just shrugged to Magic Johnson, who was courtside on the broadcast team, as if to say, hell, I can't explain it either. The draft was pretty interesting, too. After the Minnesota Timberwolves selected Laettner at number 3, there was a chorus of boos, which prompted Laettner's mother, Bonnie, a sometimes outspoken woman who, like so many moms, loved her son and wanted to protect him, blurted out to the press, huh, that was the 50 family and friends Shaquille took with him to Portland. Christian wasn't happy with her. Hey, we've all been there at one time or another. A couple other things about Portland. It had one of the great all-time bookstores, Powell's, and the peaceful Willamette River, and one of the all-time great bars, the Veritable Quandary, a hangout for the media who had covered the NBA Finals and hung around to cover the Dream Team. You went into the VQ, you ordered a craft beer, and the bartenders would put on anything you asked for. One night it was Stevie Ray Vaughan, one of the overlooked blues immortals. Stevie Ray is gone now. A helicopter crash in Wisconsin in 1990, hours after he and his band had opened a show for Eric Clapton. And alas, so is the Veritable Quandary, a victim of market forces. Nihil est aeternum. Nothing lasts forever. I'm not sure what a Latin accent should sound like, but that was probably not a good one. So why were we in Portland? Well, as I said earlier, the Americans had to qualify since they had finished third in 1988, and the qualifier had been scheduled for March in Brazil. In other words, at a time when the NBA season was still going on. So the NBA and USA Basketball arm-twisted FIBA into a schedule change and bought the broadcast rights for somewhere around $4 million from a Brazilian who owned them and rechristened the thing the Tournament of the Americas. Now, the money for the broadcast was put up by the United States Olympic Committee, which had a surplus from the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, which was quite possibly the last games that made economic sense for a host country. The USOC resented it. They were not accustomed to putting up money for millionaire professional athletes, and that resentment would prove to be a subplot in Portland that would continue through Barcelona.
I'll be tricky. And because initially all I said, you know, I don't want to be a part of this whole business. You know, I play the game for the passion. You know, I was totally against professional basketball players playing because I knew the business aspect that was going to come around it. You know, and it's hard to get the true Olympic experience when you're sitting there worrying about everybody that's making money and you got to, you know, you got to please this guy and, you know, please this company. And yet it may not be in the same line of what I'm entitled to or what I'm contracted.
Okay. Irony alert here. Jordan, who at that time was earning about $35 million in endorsements and is still, by the way, earning about $145 million, even though he hasn't played since 2003, talking about the unpleasantness of mixing business and basketball. But Jordan and most of the other Dream Teamers felt for the first time in Portland how many fingers were reaching into the pie. And Jordan didn't really need the Olympics for exposure the way other players might have. It's not like his profile wasn't amplified by the Dream Team experience, but it wasn't a major consideration. Here's David Falk, Jordan's agent at the time, and the man largely responsible for creating the Jordan marketing monster back in 1984.
I think it, gave him a broader stage and probably set the tone maybe for moving into other markets, with brand Jordan later on down the road, but he didn't do it for marketing reasons. I don't think that even entered into the equation. I knew that it would have a, a positive impact, but not a, not a major impact.
For months, there had been pitched behind-the-scenes battles among sponsors and retailers trying to make official deals with the NBA to make money off these guys. And these weren't exactly junior varsity companies. They were companies like AT&T, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Visa. The stakes were enormously high. The real battles took place over whose likeness could be put on what product. Remember that all these guys, but Jordan, Magic, Barkley, and Bird in particular, had all kinds of endorsement deals and contracts themselves. What would they be violating by wearing or endorsing a USOC-sanctioned product that was in competition with one of their personal sponsors? To wit, would Jordan, Mr. Nike, tacitly endorse Reebok? Ha! Jordan and his agent, David Falk, thought they had a deal worked out that would take care of it. But the deal, in the immortal words of William Goldman, the great Hollywood screenwriter, was apparently set, just not set. We'll see how that plays out in Barcelona. The players were astounded at what their responsibilities were, particularly in the area of signing basketballs. A couple of them told me they signed literally thousands of balls because each deal seemed to come accompanied by signed basketballs, which always struck me as crazy because if you've seen a pro athlete sign, at least most of them, you can't make out their signature from ancient Sanskrit. Here is Steve Mills on how bad the situation actually was. At that time, he was working for the league and was in charge of special events for the Dream Team and was a close confidant of many of the players.
The biggest conflict that I can remember that I think almost blew up the team was the issue, was sort of an interaction with the USOC. And it was the first time when... There was a woman, I believe, who was an athlete, but of a different sport, who was working for the USOC at the time, and came in and talked to the players about their marketing obligations and the things they couldn't do and the things that they could do.
And here's Barkley on the same subject.
What annoyed us was they got angry at us. Like, hey, we came here. We're not getting any money, and clearly Michael is the man at that point as far as endorsement goes with Nike. And we have a meeting, and a couple of the representatives like come at him like, "Hey, don't be an asshole." And we're like, "You know how Michael is? Like, excuse me."
See, the Dream Teamers were supposed to get some kind of share of all the revenue pie and a playing salary, something that added up to around $75,000. To the best of anyone's memory. In other words, pocket change. But hey, pocket change is pocket change. I tore my car apart the other day looking for 78 cents. But in stepped the ultimate diplomat, Dave Gavitt, who himself had been arm-twisted to get the players to give up that money for the good of the country and the coffers of USA Basketball. Here's Larry Bird.
Dave came to me with the idea, like, get out of here, you're crazy. He goes, come on, Birdie. And went through the whole thing, and he talked to Magic. Of course, Magic said, well, is Larry doing it? And then he went to Michael. Michael, I'm in. And he went to the other guys, and Dave came to me, and he said, hey, we're rolling with it.
Okay, enough. Let's get away from business and talk about what else was going on in Portland. A great introductory party by Nike, for one thing. I brought along my wife and two sons, who were 15 and 12, a great fan age, and introduced them around to the point that I wasn't being an ass, and as usual got the best response from Charles Barkley. You seem like nice boys, Barkley said, putting his arm around them. So with a father like you have, I would run away right now. One of the subplots was how nice this was for Clyde Drexler, who was among the last two Dream Teamers picked and was only a couple of weeks removed from getting tortured by Jordan in the finals. No matter how much he hated it, and he hated it, Clyde could never quite get past being the poor man's Michael Jordan. And his team could never quite get past being talented, but not a closer. It had started in the 1990 finals against the Pistons and was solidified by the six-game loss to the Bulls in 92. and Drexler took endless amounts of crap from his fellow Dream Teamers. Here's Bird.
I feel sorry for him some days on that bus because they sort of tell me he played on the dumbest team in the NBA.
Still, the team was tight. Relationships were starting to build, the most unlikely being a friendship between Bird and Patrick Ewing. They were together so much that the team started calling Ewing Harry so they could brand them Harry and Larry. In every single interview I did for the Dream Team, somebody brought this up. The players got such a kick out of it. It was in Portland also that the real Alpha Dog started a late-night ritual of a card game called Tonk, which Barkley described as an old Negro game from the South. The main players were Barkley, Jordan, Magic, and Pippen. So if there's any Tonk fans out there, just think how great it would have been to get in that game. Then again, you would have needed to bring money. Lots of money. In the Dream Team's second game in the Tournament of the Americas, Stockton and Michael Jordan collided on a defensive sequence. And though not many people saw it, Stockton came away with an undisplaced fracture of the right fibula. Most everybody else thought, well, so what? Stockton's great, but the Dream Team hardly needs him. But Chuck Daly, the Prince of Pessimism, who was already imagining if he would have to appear before Congress if the Dream Team lost a game, was worried about the point guard position. Chuck honestly wasn't sure that Magic could handle the load alone, particularly defensively. Ridiculous in retrospect, of course, but, and more, much more than was made public, Chuck really thought that Stockton should be replaced.
Just got the x-ray and was sitting down to eat, and I was right back at the table and said, well, we're going to need to replace you.
Daly was even a little pissed at Stockton because he clung to his spot. So Chuck convened a meeting. Okay, a dinner meeting at a great Italian restaurant in Portland. Matt Dobek, his trusted public relations man, was there, and so was assistant P.J. Carlesimo, who was in charge of restaurants. P.J. was, still is, one of basketball's great restaurant guys. You got to have guys that know every great restaurant, know every owner, and maitre d' at every great restaurant. Anyway, the subject of the meeting was, should we replace Stockton? And if we decide we should, who are we going to call? Here's the late Matt Dobek.
To make it work, they were going to call Joe. How the hell would that have been before?
In case you didn't get it, the Joe was Joe Dumars. So there it was, the specter of Isaiah Thomas all over again. Daly could not get out from under it. And the best guess from Matt, and he told me this before he died, was that Chuck would have given the call to Joe Dumars, not Isaiah Thomas. Jordan, for one, was watching these developments with interest and some degree of angst.
When Stockton broke his leg, now I'm already committed. I'm thinking, oh shit. You know, I got tricked into this thing, and next thing you know, Isaiah's gonna be on the team. And they said, we're gonna keep it the way it is because Chuck wants to take Dumars, but he can't take Dumars, so he had to leave it. He had to keep Stockton on the team, even with a broken leg. So we were there with 11 players all the time.
Eventually, Chuck decided to let it go, take the time until Barcelona for Stockton to get better, and I was glad. I love Dumars as a player and as a person, too, but I'm glad it didn't happen. That would have just been too cruel. Isaiah passed over not once, but twice, and for a teammate who really wasn't even a point guard. And for Chuck, it was actually better from a playing time standpoint. Since Bird's back was hurting so bad, and there were always other assorted injuries, not having Stockton available at all made it easier on Daly to slide players in and out. One more thing about Isaiah. We never got along all that great. He was one of the few people who turned down an interview request for the Dream Team book. He told me not long ago at a Hall of Fame gathering that he thought I had never treated him or the Pistons fairly in print. But then he shook my hand. I respected him for that, and I respected the way he handled the Dream Team snub. One of the things he did around the time of the selection process was call John Stockton's father. Here is Stockton talking about it.
I think Isaiah probably should have been, and I was the clear target, I guess, for what people thought he meant, and he probably had.
In case you didn't get it, at the end there, John said, and he called my dad. That means Isaiah Thomas called up John Stockton's father. And when Stockton was inducted into the Hall of Fame, incidentally, the player he chose to walk up with him to the stage was one Isaiah Thomas. Okay, is there anything else I've forgotten about Portland? Oh, yes. There were actually other teams there, and there were basketball games. For the record, these were the other competitors. In order of how they finished behind the U.S. were Venezuela, Brazil, Puerto Rico, Canada, Argentina, Mexico, Panama, Cuba, and Uruguay. It was a gas interacting with the players on the other teams. From the beginning, they just seemed to get it. They just understood that they were fodder for the dream team, stand-ins, second bananas. And they were fine with it. They embraced it. They understood that when the U.S. played, it was less like a traditional athletic competition and more like free-form theater with a set ending. You were going to get your ass kicked, but let's do some improv along the way. That "we know why we're here" attitude was best exemplified by Oscar Schmidt of Brazil. You have to understand this. Oscar was a legit player. He was the best player in the tournament, not on the dream team. And at one point in his career, several years earlier, many scouts believed that he was a legit NBA prospect. And here was Oscar talking before the game and, well, let's call it his goals for the Tournament of the Americas.
Larry Bird is my idol, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, so I would like to have all their autographs, for sure.
What a rallying cry. Let's go get their autographs. But look, we got it. We got it back then. You weren't going to beat the dream team, so go with the flow. Enjoy the experience. I know I did. The one moment that I remember more than all others in that summer of 1992 was the first time the dream team ran out together before the first game. It was hard to explain then, it's kind of hard to explain now, but everybody I talked to says the same thing. Dick Ebersol, the president of NBC Sports back then, was sitting in the stands with David Stern, and he told me years later that he had chills. I remember looking in the stands and locating my sons and thinking, well, whatever they will later hold against me, and let's not go there, at least I got them to this. We were all curious who would come out first, who would carry the flag, who would be in that first starting lineup, and don't think the players didn't think about it also. Here's Larry Bird.
He said, "Hey, Larry, Scotty's going to start." Great. You know, did it matter? It didn't matter to me. I started that first game.
Yeah.
That mattered.
That mattered.
And as probably the Vegas line would have had it, Magic came out first, carrying the flag. Bird was second in line. And when they hit the floor, the Cuban team stopped practicing and lined up to stare and take photos. As with Oscar Schmidt, their goal was not so much to play the game, but to say that they were there. And so the next step for the dream team was a trip to Monte Carlo before the Olympics. Hey, that's where everyone goes to get in some grunt work, right? Monte Carlo. See you next time when I'll give you the deets behind the immortal inter-squad scrimmage. The greatest game nobody ever saw. Thanks for listening.
If you enjoyed the Dream Team tapes, please follow, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. The Dream Team tapes is written and hosted by Jack McCallum. Executive producers, Mark Francis and Scott Waxman. Executive producer for iHeartMedia is Sean Tutone. The Dream Team Tapes is a Diversion Podcast's original series in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.